have any practice questions that they'd like to bring up at this point? Yes, would you pass this back to Terry, please?
I had a question about what we were talking about at the end of the last Dharmatalk, and understanding that the world is not knowable in a certain sense, because it's always known through a set of senses. Then why does that not make us separate from everything? I mean, we're not. We're obviously not. But that was the question that came to my mind.
Why does... What is knowing that make
us
separate?
Yeah, why does us being so dependent on our senses keep us apart? Why doesn't it keep us apart? I mean, it obviously doesn't. I can talk to you and communicate and something happens between us.
Right.
So,
I was
curious. It seemed like it would.
Okay. It's, why does that fact not keep us apart? Okay, it's not knowing that fact that leads to us thinking in a particular way that does keep us apart. Okay? That's what I was getting at. That when you discover that you don't know as much as you thought you did, and that things aren't the way you thought they were, it opens you up to a new path of discovery and understanding, which leads to a different way of thinking and seeing yourself and others. And it's that different way of seeing yourself and your relationship with others that makes us less separate from each other and causes us to suffer less. It both causes us to suffer less because our suffering is really coming from inside ourselves all along. But it also makes us stop doing the things that cause other people to suffer. Because the only reason that we do things that cause other people to suffer is we think that there's a difference between ourselves and them. And we view things in such a way that, okay, I can create this advantage for myself, more happiness and less suffering for myself, by doing something that is going to increase the suffering of others. So.
Sometimes the stupidity does that too. Lack of skill
That's
means.
Lack. You're absolutely right. We not only make that mistake through a misguided understanding of things, in which case we're really doing it intentionally based on misguided understanding, but we also do it a lot unintentionally. So that's kind of a different problem. You know, we have to become skillful in order to make an even greater difference. But it does bring up a very important point, which is another thing that we need to understand, and that's that we can never truly know and predict the results of our actions. So we can become more wise, and we can become more skillful, but we shouldn't expect of ourselves to achieve a level of skillfulness that we actually go through the world never doing anything that has untoward consequences. That's just not realistic, you know. There's just no way to predict the long-term consequences. The farther away you get from the present moment, the harder it is to predict the consequences of that action. And I think there's a little story that I've used before, and you may have already heard it. Don't, probably shouldn't repeat it again, but I will anyway. So suppose that this is a little bit of fiction, but somebody on the streets of Vienna, Austria, sometime around the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, sees a runaway carriage heading towards a young woman who's pregnant. And out of the goodness of his heart, he pushes her out of the way of the carriage. But that was the mother of Adolf Hitler. So you never know the consequences of your actions. You can only be as skillful as you can. So, yeah.
I just want to make sure I remembered something that you said in our interview. I asked about what stages you might be able to have real existence-changing insight experiences. And I mean, you said it could happen by fluke at any stage, but where did you say it would happen somewhat more predictably?
Yeah, well, it does become more predictable at every stage, or not more predictable, more likely, sorry. It becomes more likely at every stage. Because what it is the training of your mind. You're shaping your mind so that there's two things. One is that when you have an insight experience, you're more likely to appreciate it as one, so that there's a greater chance that it will lead to insight. And we're actually having insight experiences all the time. The other change it makes is as your mind becomes trained in this way, it also allows certain kinds of more powerful insight experiences to arise. Now, when you get to stage six, you have very stable attention and quite powerful mindfulness, and you've developed a fair bit of introspective awareness. A lot of that's metacognitive, so you've got a lot of the tools in place. Not the tools. Let's put it the other way. You're approaching the peak of the development of these particular mental skills. So at that point, you really become very ripe. You know, if going through stages one through five was like that, there's kind of a break. But then you get to six, and the probability curve starts to go upward. And until by the time you get to stage seven, the probability curve of having insight experiences that you recognize and appreciate and that lead to actual insight, the probability curve starts to become very steep at stage seven. So that's the trajectory.
So it sounds like once you get past subtle dullness, because there you might be at risk of just having sort of a stoner realization.
that could be part of it. Yeah. But you see, what you're doing in stage five is you're making your mind much more powerful, and so it's that additional conscious power that is opening up the possibility.
Why do you bow to the Buddha over there? What are the meanings of each of the gestures to you, and what's kind of going on?
What's going on in my mind when I do that?
Right.
Okay. When I do that, I do it three times. You know, and there's the body, speech, and mind. Right? So the first time, I'm reminding myself to leave all of my personal self aside. And the second time, I embody speech and mind. The second time I do it, I am offering myself as a vehicle for the Dharma and embody speech and mind. And then the third time I do it, it is I'm offering my body, speech, and mind as the vehicle to be of benefit to everyone that hears what I have to say. So it's a little personal ritual that I do. And so I do it with different things in mind at different times. But when I come in here and I do it before I'm going to teach, that's exactly what I think.
Head is body.
Yes, body, speech, and mind. You might wonder, isn't it the other way around?
Actually, in Buddhism, they say the mind is in the heart.
Yeah. Well, that's
that you think with your heart.
That's a common view held in many Eastern cultures. It's not really Buddhist. It's just, you know, there are interesting cultural differences between East and West, and that is a very distinctive one. That. In Western culture, the Greeks, everybody, you know, it's mind's up here, right? And in the East, oh, the mind's in here. So that's why it is that way. And I suppose it would probably might even be a more effective ritual if I did it the other way around.
Yeah.
Mind, speech, and body. It may resonate more deeply with my culturally ingrained ways of thinking of things. But somehow I don't think it stands in the way.
No.
Another interesting difference between culture East and West that I'm sure you're all familiar with is that in the East, in the West, there's a huge emphasis on the individual. Right? And even to the point that says that the social group, the tribe, the nation, exists for the benefit of the individual. The Eastern perspective is the opposite of that. That it's and of course, this is what makes families so strong in the East, is that the family, the tribe, the social group, the nation, that is given priority, and the individual is secondary to the larger whole and in service to it. So, of course, that's changing now. That's changing because Easterners are becoming more individualistic and adopting all these Western mindsets. And of course, more and more Westerners are discovering that we're really not as separate as we thought we were. and seeing their relationship to. As a matter of fact, I sometimes think that the country that we're in lags farther behind the rest of the Western world in that shift. And something very interesting that I saw was a quote somewhere. I look at news headlines in the morning just to see if World War III has started or if the hurricane coming to Arizona or something like that. And there was a quote from somebody to the effect that, you know, talking about the current situation in this country, is that it's far more important to be a good citizen than to be a good Republican or a real Democrat. And I thought, yeah, if only people could understand that. But our country's kind of going in the wrong direction, you know. It's all this us against them, me first, and my group first, and my race first, and my state first, and my political party first. I'm kind of going the wrong way. So, anyway, that's an aside. Body, speech, and mind, because Asians always think that the mind is doing great.
Yeah. it's more about practice question.
Yeah.
So let's say that you practice and suddenly you have you're at stage 5 and you have a strong experience of stage 7 where you have only breath sensations. And as you say, you can even not locate your nose. And the day after, it's the aftermath. You can even have stage 2.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it normal? Because for me, basically, I think the way I approach meditation, as there is a lot of conditioning for the things I used to do before.
Yeah.
So drugs, for instance. So I would like to have you have something to say about that?
To say about the fact that you can be a stage 5 and have stage 7 experiences and then fall back to stage 2?
Yes, for me it was like stage 7. It was almost 1 hour 45 minutes sitting. I had to do nothing, and even when I sat down, no pain, nothing. But the day after, it was wild. It took me 5 sessions just to go to stage 2, stage 3. So my question is that the things I used to do before, do you think it has an impact to the way I do meditation now?
The things that you have done before have an impact on your meditation now?
Yeah. My approach.
Your what?
My approach of meditation and some kind of craving about sensations, and when you no longer have them, you see what I mean? The mind is not... I don't know if I'm clear about my question.
We'll get there. Okay, so are you talking about the kinds of meditation you did before, or your lifetime conditioning, or...?
Yes, it's because soon I'm talking so about drugs, actually. So when you take some drugs, actually, it puts your mind in a certain state.
Yes.
And actually, you can have experience, but as you said last year, you can have some experience, but depending on how many parts of the mind are unified, it will make a difference.
Yes.
So...
Let me talk about this in a little bit, and then if it's not on track with your question, we can have another go at it, or you can try to make it clear. But all of these things tie together. So no matter what stage you're at in terms of what you can consistently do, certain things can come together in just the right way. For you to have an experience at a relatively advanced state. And actually, that's a good thing, because if your mind has that experience, now your mind knows something that it didn't before. It knows what can happen. And to some degree, your mind knows it knows not only that such a place exists, but it knows something of how it got there. So it's going to be easier to get back there another time. Now this is where experiences that you might have had before are similar in that. So doing other kinds of practices, or using drugs, or other kinds of practices could include many things. If you do certain shamanic practices, they produce certain mental states. If you play music and you get into a flow state in music, and you learn how to do that, and you do it easily, then later on, your mind's going to recognize when you get to the state point that you can practice jhanas, you're going to recognize, you may not consciously think this, but your mind's going to know, I know where this, I've been there, I know how to get there. It's going to be very easy for you to enter that jhana, because your mind knows what these flow states are like. If you use drugs, now drugs have two effects. One thing they do is certain kinds of drugs totally alter the way your brain works. And so you have completely different perceptions, totally different kind of experience. Same sensory information coming in, but your mind does something totally different with it. And that can be a kind of insight experience. You know, at the very least, what it did for me and a lot of people back in the 60s is it cracked us wide open to the possibility that, wow, you know, the way I see things, there's a whole lot of different possibilities than I ever thought before the way I could see things. So those kinds of experiences, one effect they had on a lot of people, you know, a lot of people went from, take Ram Dass for example, you know, went from dropping LSD to going to India to learn to meditate. That happened to a lot of people at different places, but started with that. So those experiences can create the desire to pursue further those kinds of mind-opening and insight-creating experiences. The other thing is they leave an imprint. What a lot of people have had using psychedelics is they'll have an experience. It will be short-lived, but it will be something very profound. They may have recognized the, for example, they may have recognized the oneness of everything. And they'll not forget that. It's a peak experience rather than a kind of insight that transforms the way we see things. But they'll never forget how wonderful it was to be in that place of seeing everything as one, as interconnected. There being no separate self, and that sense of the freedom that comes from no longer being this isolated separate self. They won't forget that. They may not know how to go back there again. They may drop acid a whole lot more times trying to get back there. But if they meditate, once the conditions are right, their mind will recognize that. It'll find its way back to that place. Their mind knows the value of having that insight. So it's the same thing. Anything that you've ever done that has put your mind in a state that is similar to an advanced meditation state. As a result of that, your mind is going to recognize it when it starts approaching that again. And likewise, when you begin to have insights, if you've had these kinds of peak experiences, you brought up drugs, and that's why I mentioned LSD, but people can have these kinds of experiences under all kinds of different circumstances, and they may be religious or spiritual experiences or part of some other practice, you know, or it might have just happened naturally, you know, they were just overcome by the wonder of nature and suddenly had some spiritual insight. Nevertheless, the mind doesn't forget, and having once been there and having once tasted that, it creates a predisposition. So yeah, your past experiences can facilitate your future meditation experiences, including those that come seemingly before their time. Now, the situation you described is by far the norm, as we talked about the other day. We describe it as a linear process, but it's anything but. Most of your practice may be at stage five, but there's the sum of the work that gets done in stage two and stage three that you haven't really polished those skills. But at the same time, the circumstances come together and you find yourself in stage seven or stage eight or who knows where. That's it. And that's fine. And so you can be in stage five, and then the next sit you're in stage eight, and then the next day you're in stage two. And it just, you know, that's really just the way it should be. The thing is, if you have a more advanced experience, it's good in two ways. One is that it gives you a taste of what lies ahead, and that can be very helpful when doubt arises. You know, remind yourself, okay, I know what can happen. So that can be very good. The other thing too is at a non-conscious level, your mind knows a little bit more about that place. Now the downside is if you get attached to it and you say, okay, this happened yesterday, it's got to happen again today. You know, that was a fluke. And so you've got to just appreciate it and be glad for the benefit that it brings to you, right? But don't get attached to it. What's important is when you can consistently hit those experiences, when you cover the ground in between. And then when you do it consistently, when you're consistently at stage 7, then don't feel bad when you find yourself back at stage 3 or stage 4, because the work at stage 3 and stage 4 is going to allow you to be even more consistent in stage 7 and then stage 8 and then stage 9. Did that touch
the question? Oh, yes. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. So,
I just had a thought that was kind of related to your question, and I have no idea if this is off the wall, but I wondered whether perhaps you just got really excited because you had that experience, and that sort of agitates the mind and causes all the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And perhaps in some ways, some parts of the mind like need to assimilate that experience.
Yeah.
And so the stage 2 might also be part of that assimilation thing.
That's a very good point, Carrie. You're absolutely right. Yes. You know, a lot of times sitting back is just because there's excitement, there's agitation, there's strong desire, and of course, when you can't do it again, then there's disappointment, there's frustration, the mind gets more agitated. So, yeah, that is part of it. Would you like to pass it up to John?
I've had experiences where things get weird in meditation and it feels like something's wrong, and there have been sort of two ways that it's corrected itself, if I want to slice it that way. One is that there was nothing wrong and there was a rough patch because of whatever. You know, I had an experience where there was agitation, but I didn't feel like I was straining or overexerting, and I didn't know what to do or why it was happening. And you said it's just because of some other stuff that was happening. It was, of your opinion, that was just coming up out of the mind for certain reasons and just practice as normal. And then things corrected themselves. And the mind didn't have to do, there was no top-down stuff that had to happen, no course correction. Then there have been other instances where there was indeed a need for course correction. And sometimes, in fact, a long time went where I, under the premise that if you just let things be, they'll correct themselves, I didn't engage in course correction, and it turned out that the course needed a little bit of correcting. You know, for instance, I mentioned yesterday the time where I was understanding introspective awareness wrong and practicing wrongly because of it. Now, I periodically encounter times where things feel not quite right, which is not surprising given that there is no right. Like you said, you're going up through the stages, you're going down through the stages, it's just a wild ride. But because I've had this experience where sometimes you need to do something, sometimes you don't, I find myself often overcome with uncertainty about not only what to do, but whether to do anything, and whether by my inaction I'm letting something that is wrong continue. How do I figure out when there needs to be something done versus when to just let it be?
Well, that's really where having a teacher comes in, very, very valuable, very important. But the other thing is just keep in mind that most of the time, it's not something that needs to be corrected. And even when it is, a lot of the time, well, eventually that's going to become apparent, right? So I would say, just as a rule of thumb, most of the time, it's either going to be apparent, become apparent what's going to have to happen, or there's really nothing that you need to do at all. So try not to get caught up in the thinking and the worrying and trying this and that and the other. So that's probably the most important thing, because you can really you can cause yourself more problems through allowing the uncertainty and the doubt and everything to grab hold. On the other hand, especially the more experienced you become, if you suspect that there may be something that you should be doing differently, you know, that there's some part of the instruction you misunderstood or something like that, if you can see a way to test that, to experiment with that, then by all means do that. And I know you've done that. And you've found that sometimes, no, I tried that, it didn't really make any difference, the problem's the same, and other times you found it. But yeah, that really helped. So, but in terms of the balance of these two, better to err on the side of just keep practicing and doing nothing. And then talk about it with a teacher, or read and study, or talk about it with other practitioners. One thing that is really enormously valuable is, you know, most of us are not going to be able to be in close proximity with a teacher all the time, but is to be a part of a community where a lot of other people are traveling the same journey, because a lot of them are going to have the answer to your question. And this is something that one of my goals, what I'd like to see happen with the Sangha that develops, like there's a community in Tucson, and they have the potential to be very valuable resources for each other. But I have to get them to the point where they're willing to discuss their meditation experiences freely, and to ask each other. And it's interesting the reluctance that people have. People, you know, they want to talk about it with the teacher. So to the degree that you can be a part of a community, and the wonderful thing nowadays is it doesn't necessarily have to be a community that you live next door to. As a part of what I'm trying to do in Tucson on the Dharma Treasure website, we've got a community discussion group. The idea here is that these are all people that are doing similar practices, but these are all people that can help each other. The amount of conversation that's taking place on there isn't very great yet, but if you look at the conversations that are happening, they're exactly what I wanted to see, is that somebody asks a question about what's happening in their meditation, and other meditators respond with, you know, well, I went through that too, and this is what it means, this is what you can do, or don't worry about it, or sometimes the replies are, I've heard another teacher say such and such. So, in addition to having a teacher, have a community of other people that can help and support you. And there's all kinds of other reasons why I would like to see you get as many people you're associated with as possible to be studying this Dharma and doing this practice. You know. But it'd be really beneficial for you.
Rob?
This is an extension of something that we've talked about. In the context of having intense emotional purification, right, where you're trying to make the physical sensation of the of whatever it is, you know, the object. And we've also talked about loving kindness meditation in that context. So, which of those two practices is preferable? Is it better to do, if it's possible, without lots of anxiety or heavy agitation coming up, is it preferable to go back to the shamatha practice to use the sensation of the object over doing loving kindness? Or would, is it better to do loving kindness for a while and see if that helps clear a little bit and then come back to it? Or which, assuming that, that both are possible in any particular sit, does one take precedence over the other? Or is it just a matter of this one feels better this time? And...
Yeah. Well, just to clarify so that everybody knows what we're talking about, these purifications that happen when old stuff, old conditioning, emotional traumas, things like that come up, they can be very intense. And one of the things that's very helpful to do when there is that kind of intense purification taking place is to switch to loving-kindness meditation. And so what Brian's asking is there's some kind of, I think this is what he's asking, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, is there some kind of rule of thumb of how much you should do of each? There isn't, of course, because every purification is different and every person is different. But your goal when something like this comes up is to get to the place where you can come to a really clear place of acceptance, letting go, basically being freed of the burden of this experience and the residue that's left or this conditioning that you've been carrying around. That is the goal. And that only comes through being able to be totally with this thing, whatever it is. Okay? So then everything you do is geared towards helping you to be with this thing in a state of total acceptance, to get to that point where it loses its power over you. So that's the role that the loving kindness plays. So it's a really powerful medicine. It's kind of an emotional painkiller, right? And you need enough painkiller to be able to, using a medical analogy, you know, to be able to perform the procedure that's necessary to correct it. And so how much you need is going to depend on the individual circumstances. So this is something that you have to decide for yourself. There, as long as you never lose sight of the fact that the most important thing to do is to get this thing totally out in the open, every part of the worst part of it, and be all right with it, then then you can trust yourself. If you're, to the extent that you're not clear on that, to the extent that the part of your mind that has always wanted to run away and hide everything every time this thing came up, to the extent that that's there, there's going to be a little bit of the desire to use the painkiller as a way to avoid confronting the situation. But I don't think that's going to be much of a problem. As long as you really understand that until you deal with it, it's going to keep haunting you. It's never going to go away. So as long as you have that in mind, you can use as many other methods that make it helpful to do. You know, if some things are just so the emotional intensity of them is so great that you're really going to have to sneak up on them by small increments, which means that you do what you can, and then when you realize the time has come for a strategic retreat, then you switch to loving kindness meditation or acts of service or anything to put you in a different frame of mind, let you regroup, recover your strength, and prepare yourself to try again. And to not get discouraged. The one thing that I think is very easy to recognize is that the more painful it is to confront something, the more wonderfully better you're going to be, the more the huge, dramatic the change is going to be once you've dealt with it. So you kind of keep that in mind. And you know, so rather than get discouraged because you're finding this really hard thing to confront and deal with, it's just say, wow, is this ever going to be good once I work through? Is this ever going to make a difference? So instead of being discouraged, you're encouraged. And you know, even if you recognize that there's some part of you resorting to doing loving kindness or some other practice as an escape from confronting it, don't judge yourself for that. Don't criticize yourself, and don't turn it into a reason to push yourself more than you should. Because the fact is that sometimes some of these things are so big that you're not going to be able to work through them by yourself on a cushion with your eyes closed. The fact is that some of these things, I don't know that it would be necessarily true of anyone here, but could be true of anyone. You're going to find something that you're going to need much more conventional therapy. You're going to need to spend some hours talking to a counselor. You're going to need somebody with all the right skills to get you to the place where you can look this thing in the eye. Our minds are very complicated. We tend to build up layers and layers of defenses. Sometimes something that brings up anger, it turns out that the anger was just a mask. Underneath that was fear. And it can go the other way too. Sometimes something brings up anxiety and guilt. But once you get past the anxiety and guilt, you find something very different, which could be anger. You just don't know. And because of this complexity, sometimes it's enormously useful to have somebody that you totally trust, that has the skills to help you untangle this. Because somebody else can look at you, and they can listen to you, and they can say, the body language totally doesn't match what you're saying. You know, and so they can see something that you can never see. I suppose you could talk to yourself in a mirror, but I don't think it would work. So, don't don't hesitate. Nobody should ever hesitate to resort to professional counseling. If they find themselves confronting something and they use every strategy they can and can't make progress with it, well, seek skilled professional counseling. Never hesitate. Don't feel like you shouldn't have to do that. I've seen a lot of times people who, they start out, they hear about these things, these purifications, and they say, yeah, I can see where a lot of people need that.
Yeah.
Not me. And, you know, somewhere along the line, they find that there's something. It was so deeply buried that their armor was this belief that, yeah, all those other people are screwed up, and why have I ever seen it but me? I'm not one of them. That's just part of their armor. Eventually they come to see that. So you never know what you're going to find when you start digging around in your psyche. The fact is, many of the most emotionally traumatic things that we've experienced in our life, we forget. They're blocked from our memory until something may happen 30 years later, and all of a sudden you remember something. And you know about that. So you never know what you're going to find in there.
One thing that I find myself doing more off the cushion than on is searching for that memory, searching for some psychological kind of, well, I remember this, that, you know, whatever my mom did when I was 6 years old or whatever. Is there any level that that's beneficial? Or, I mean, certainly it can be overdone because it's still just a story.
Yeah. Okay, so the way to look at this, the way to approach this is that this thing doesn't want to be seen, or it doesn't want to be seen for what it really is. It comes out with disguises, and it's good at hiding itself often. I mean, the stronger something is and the more deeply buried it is, the more reluctant it is. So now, if you start digging into your memory banks, think, you know, is there something my mother did? And this part of your mind is comparing, you know, you remember something and say, oh, maybe that was it. And this part of your mind says, yeah, that was it. That was it. Not me. You know, how is that? So, you know, the best approach is, you know, you've got to let it come up by itself. And you've got to you've got to be careful not to frighten it away, and you've got to recognize that it's going to often come up wearing a variety of disguises, you know, and you're just going to have to let it do that. But thinking about it and deliberately delving into your past is one of, it has a little bit of utility, but it's most often a huge waste of time. Because the stuff that comes up isn't the stuff that you're looking for. You just almost guarantee that. But every now and then, if you get a clue and you can try to recollect, then, you know, don't dig too deep, but if you feel like you've gotten a clue, you might go ahead and look a little bit. But keep in mind, it might be a red herring. On the other hand, maybe this part of you, you see, it really, it, although it's busy hiding, it really wants to get resolved, ultimately. And so it might be pointing you in the right direction, but don't waste a lot of time on that either. And, you know, things things can come up in dreams. And if you have a dream that really seems to be about you, but it doesn't correspond to anything that you remember, it might be an important message. So don't discount it, and don't take it at face value. You're closest to the microphone, and both hands went at the same time, so you get to go first.
It was kind of related to this question. I wasn't sure whether you meant like practice like a formal loving kindness, or did you mean like practicing loving kindness towards that emotional state?
It includes both. You see, practicing loving kindness involves rousing these feelings, this mental state, these positive mental states in yourself. And that itself has a tremendous value. So, you know, there's a part of you that's clinging to the suffering that this holds. And so if you rouse in yourself the mental state of what it's like to be free from suffering and be completely at ease, you're actually dealing with the problem in a way by doing that. Which there often is, there is some deep-seated anger associated with this. And you practice generating a mental state of what it's like to be completely free from ill will and at peace with everything and everyone. Once again, you're not doing it directly or intrusively or in a way that's going to create resistance. Although there might be some resistance, if you try to generate a mental state of being completely at peace, and you find that you have trouble doing it, you know, and this part of your mind says, this is a stupid thing to be doing, then you know that the anger and resentment, it's part of whatever it is there that you're trying to deal with. The other thing when you're doing loving kindness meditation is that you're directing this, and so you direct it out, and you start by directing it where it's easiest to direct it. But you gradually work towards places where it's hardest to direct it. So if you have fear or anger or guilt that involves somebody else, then in the process of directing it to other people, you're likely to, sooner or later, start to come into that vicinity. And, you know, when you start directing loving kindness towards the people that have hurt you, then you're doing some good work, and you're really giving an opportunity for some of these things to come to the surface. The same thing, you know, whether it's fear or guilt. You know, that's an interesting thing. Guilt, if you're feeling guilty about something you did to somebody else, you might find it hard to send loving kindness to them. Right? A lot of funny things like that. But anyway, as you're sending loving kindness to more and more difficult people, you always end up sending it to the most difficult person in your life, who is yourself, exactly, right. And so ultimately, you know, there's this part of you that has been causing you so much suffering and so many problems, and you don't want to conquer that part of yourself. You want to love it into submission. Yes, right. You want to reintegrate it. You want to make yourself whole. It's always going to be a part of you. And it is the way it is, and it's operating the way it does for good, sound, solid reasons. But you want to get to that place where it can be reintegrated into the rest of who you are and can stop clinging to whatever it was that made it start being the way it is. So yes, you're sending loving kindness to that part of yourself.
I had a therapist who said that those things come up to be healed when it's time. And I thought that was a really interesting way to understand it.
That they come up.
Those feelings and those things, they come up to be healed when they have the
exactly.
sense that it's possible.
Yes, they do. They come up.
Really interesting.
You see, often those things only come up when something triggers them. You know, and it's like a reflex. And when that happens, they're not looking to be healed. They see this as their job. But when they start coming up at other times, and that's so wonderful about, if it starts coming up in meditation, it's really saying, you know, I really want to be healed. I really want to be whole. You know, it's quite different than when it comes up in response to trigger.
Yeah.
Thank you. So let's pass this to Nick. He was...
Does purification happen in stages 5 and 6 as well as 4 and 7 or only in 4 and 7?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Okay. Does a purification happen in stages 5 and 6? What happens in stage, say you're in stage 5 or stage 6 and a purification happens, it presents itself as a gross distraction, right? So by definition, so you may have been practicing for hours or days or weeks at stage 5 or stage 6, but you suddenly find yourself back at stage 4 having a purification. So the answer is yes, but as soon as it happens, you're in stage 4 by definition.
Will 7, the purification in 7 take you down as well?
It depends. The purifications in stage 7, you know, once again, I'm drawing on my personal experience and what I've seen in other people. So I find the purifications that happen in stage 7 are in a category, you know, there are two ends of the extreme. In stage 4, a lot of the stuff in the middle happens. In stage 7, there's the stuff that is so deeply buried that there was no hope of it coming up in stage 4. And there's the stuff that's not buried at all. It's so woven into everything about the way you are all of the time. But until then, it's been invisible. Okay? Now, in stage 7, if it's a deeply buried kind of something, then it's going to it's going to present itself as a very powerful distraction. It's going to require a lot of attention, and you're going to end up having to take it as the object. So, yeah, you could say it walks you back to stage 4. On the other hand, these other things, they really appear, you know, you've got this powerful metacognitive introspective awareness operating, and you're sitting through these long periods where your attention is on the meditation object, and you know there's not too much happening, and you start to see what you couldn't see before, and so they appear, they start to, you know the image starts to appear out of nowhere, and you start to see. You might have some very strong emotional reactions to that. And you might decide to work through those emotional reactions in meditation. But often what you'll find is that you work through them outside. As things start to appear in meditation, then after the meditation, you start to see this, and you recognize, and you see this tendency you've had. You start to think and remember, I've been doing this every day. All, you know, and it all starts to come back to you. And so you go back into meditation, and once again, in the light of peripheral awareness, even more emerges. So you don't necessarily go back to, you don't necessarily go to the place of taking it as a primary object of attention. So, once again, you know, it's, I have created a structure of definitions, and therefore we could say that technically stage 7 purifications can bump you back to stage 4, or they might happen all in stage 7. Could happen either way.
So one moral is you don't need to hang out at stage 4 until all the purification is done. You just
no,
carry
absolutely.
On up and...
That's right. There's, you just when you find yourself having extended periods of stage 5 quality meditation, you practice stage 5. If they become the norm, you're at stage 5 until something that was left unpurified comes up, then you deal with it. So. Yes, Tim. Is it switch all the way up? Maybe it's time.
I don't know. The question I had was, I think meditating around stage 4, and none of these exciting purification experiences have been coming up. I realize that there's probably nothing I can do about it, but is it likely that there's something going on, or is it just that I haven't been hanging out at stage 4 long enough?
Most likely there is stuff, but just don't worry about it. Just because everybody else is having powerful purifications, don't feel left out. you may be the rare individual that really doesn't have that kind of emotional psychic trauma to deal with, or you've already dealt with it. But trust that as you go along, if there is anything there, it's going to come up, and you just deal with it when it does.
I had this slight problem that I thought it was stage... I thought I was at stage 4, but I was actually at stage 5 or something like that. And what I thought were subtle distractions. Or sorry, I don't know what it was. I was squashing them down a little too much before mm-hmm. they could. And then when I realized, oh, wait, no, these are things I need to listen to, then it was like the floodgates. So there may be... you may be squishing them.
That seems likely.
Yes. Thank you, Andrew. That is a really important point. It's very easy to sort of get in, instead of just let it come, let it be, let it go on its own, that yeah, you want to squish things down, and then so you have something that it's saying, hey, look at me, and you're not recognizing it, you're saying go away, I'm going to do something else. Yeah, but that is very true. It's a good reminder that anything that comes up, you always just let it be there. Even at stage 6, where you're looking for subtle distractions to disappear, you don't make them disappear. You just let them be in the background, and you deny them attention. But at stage 4, and this is true later stages as well, when you can't succeed at ignoring something and it starts to push hard, then you switch and you focus your attention on it and see what this is about.
Okay.
So,
set it up to me. I'm going to see if I can get away with him too.
So I'm in a situation similar. I'm sorry. Yeah. So you know, I'm past stage four, and I have had exactly one mild purification experience pertaining to a very recent event. So if I think it's safe to say that that is probably not the extent of what needs purifying in my messed up head. And it's a little alarming, but I'm trying to maybe stage seven is going to be a real roller coaster. I don't know, but I just occurred to me. So one thing that I do have is songs. We've talked about this. I have songs stuck in my head.
Oh, man.
And maybe I don't have them more than other people, but I have them. They are my grossest. They are my strongest distractions by far. More than anything personal. More than memories. I have memories come up, tra-la-la, they come, be, go. But I have songs, and they vie for my attention more strongly than anything else. They will stay for multiple sessions, the same song. They will play out in detail. My mind will begin to do musical elaborations on the theme sometimes. What was I going to say? I don't remember. But
were you wondering if the songs were masking something?
What I was going to say is that I usually then it occurs to me that I heard this song in a time where there was something I was a little ashamed of, or there was a time where I was something didn't go the way I wanted it to go, and I felt like a wasted opportunity, and that occurred to me that these songs seem to be touchstones to emotionally significant times. Is it possible that those are purifications that are just too shy to be themselves? And is there something I can do?
It's way more than possible. It's highly probable. I think you're really onto something here. And as your teacher, I apologize for it not occurring to me earlier. This is exactly... Why didn't I think of it? It can be the lyrics to the song. It could be the emotional associations with... You know, we form very powerful emotional associations with music and with odors, too, by the way. You find yourself reacting strongly to a particular odor or smelling something that you know is not there. That might be a cue as well. But yeah, I think you stumbled on something very important here. So if you have emotional associations with a particular piece of music, It can even,
And I don't always even know. Like, I was doing a walking meditation when it occurred to me that the song that had been in my head for 3 hours was from a time where there was some weird stuff. So the song doesn't always come with a label of, I'm an emotionally resonant song. Sometimes it's just, this song will not go away. But then if I think about it, maybe even outside of my page, so what should I do? I mean, because I don't feel purified, I just feel annoyed by these stupid songs that won't go away.
No, that's right. So,
how do I make use of
it? If there is an emotional association with the song, you did have that come up. Basically, the way I would see it is that song was telling you, hey, this is what I'm really about.
Right.
And so you should let that come up. The song is no longer important. It's the emotion. And if there's particular memories associated with that, that's what's important. Those things. And so that'll be the key. The purification is going to happen when it becomes clear to you what this whole thing is all about. So just playing the song in your mind and doing riffs isn't going to get to the root of it.
No, and I'm certainly not deliberately doing that. But this sounds a little bit, I have to say, this sounds a little bit like the sort of rabbit hole chasing that you advise Brian against. And I know that there must be some distinction, but because in this case, the emotion is not...
Remember, the other thing I said to Brian is sometimes these things can be a hint.
Sure.
And so, it's pointing you towards the next clue on the hunt. I'll point out to you that it may not actually be the events that you recall, but the emotions you experience in response to those events, they may have roots in something else. And so that, you know, it's like, I don't know, that game where you got a clue and you follow it, and then you get the next clue and you do the one after that.
Clue?
Is that what it's called? Clue? the only thing I can, I know it's a game that I've never played, but they have a version of it on television where they've got these teams that...
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Let's not do this. I'll stop. Anyway, this is a rabbit hole.
To start thinking about it and analyzing it is not going to be terribly productive, but if you recall those emotions, those events, with the idea that there may be something else there, then this might come further.
And if a song is, if it's not obvious, like, if there's just a song and it will not go away, and it's one of these songs that is not just in the background, but is powerful, is taking my attention away, should I ask myself if this comes from a certain, like, should I try and do that, or do I just wait until it...
You try a little bit, but not too much.
Okay.
Remember that these things often, when you look at them too directly, that's when they hide. So mostly, you just want to invite it, maintain this attitude of being open, welcome, but not too aggressively either.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you. The time's up, but we have time for... We'll make time for one more. I just turned it on again.
Oh, it's not lights on.
But I shouldn't be on.
So, I was just going to say, having experienced a lot of intensive communication on many levels, but one thing I noticed, like, yeah, I was in retreat. I even made all these like changes, so I didn't have anything to plan, nothing to do, nothing. Like, I mean, I did all these elaborate things, and I'm planning. Still, there's planning
going on in the. Oh, okay.
Planning going on a lot about. I mean, I was just fabricating things to plan, and what it turned out to be was that. It was related to, behind that was another thing and another thing and another thing that was related to something from very early in my life that I, you know, like, and it opened up a lot of things for me. So those kinds of things that come and keep coming, and then may seem like just innocuous things because you've been doing them, or in my case, I've done that all my life and I still do it because it's one of those fabric of the life things, you know. So it's like the planning is to help prevent the anxiety, which is about this, it dialed back. It's not about the story, because it's going to be different for everybody, and it dialed back and dialed back and dialed back until I was, you know, a baby. And then those things come up, so, and it's very useful. And so I watched that happen now, and it's like, there you are again, I know who you are. I know what you're about. You know, I still have to deal with it, and I still follow it sometimes. But, I found that you never know how they're going to come disguised.
Thank you.
And they were helping me with it today.
One more quick remark from Jason. We've got to go out in the rain. Can't miss the rain.
So, I don't know if you would recommend this, but one thing that I've done for this, and use this at your own risk.
Don't worry about it, Jason.
Testing.
There's a bad connection on the battery.
All right. Is trying to like follow the emotional associations of the thing and the associations from the emotion.
Yeah.
And pay particular attention to those associations that intensify the emotion. And
yeah.
Follow those. So it's sort of like deliberately trying to intensify it, but with the associations that come from it. Like like, you don't want to just do anything to intensify the emotion, like, just work yourself up into a rage. You want to try to follow the associations from the anger that's there and see which one is really intensified. That can make it quite intense, so follow at your own risk, but it's quite useful.
But that is, that's a very skillful way of presenting. Okay. Thank you all. Good discussion.